The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service and the Associated Press. First of all, an article published by the Religion News Service on the 25th of July, written by Adele M. Banks, and entitled Emmett Till Memorialized in Monument That Includes Chicago Church. For the Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr., it was the moment he had long awaited and once could not have envisioned. The older cousin of Emmett Till, Parker is the sole remaining witness to the 1955 kidnapping of the black teenager, who was dragged from his bed to face a lynching that galvanized the civil rights movement. Now Parker has lived to see the designation of a church in Chicago and two other sites in Mississippi as the Emmett Till and Mamie Till Mobley National Monument. I sat with my family on the night of terror when Emmett Till, our beloved Bobo, was taken from us, taken to be tortured and brutally murdered, Parker recalled as he introduced President Joe Biden at a ceremony on Tuesday, July 25, at the Eisenhower Executive Office Building near the White House before the signing of the proclamation establishing the monument. Back then, in the darkness, I could never imagine a moment like this, standing in the light of wisdom, grace, and deliverance. The new monument, which will honor Roberts Temple Church of God in Christ in the Bronzeville neighborhood on Chicago's South Side, where Till's mother insisted on an open casket funeral so attendees could see what had happened to her son. Also designated in the announcement is Grable Landing near Glendora, Mississippi, believed to be the site where Till's body was found after white men murdered him, after he had been accused of whistling at a white woman. They had attempted to dispose of the body by weighing it down in the Tallahatchie River with a fan blade from a cotton gin. The third site is the county courthouse in nearby Sumner, where two men were acquitted by an all-white jury. They later admitted to their crimes in a magazine interview. At a time when there are those who seek to ban books, bury history, we're making it clear, crystal clear, said Biden, drawing applause at the ceremony that occurred on the 82nd anniversary of Till's death. While darkness and denialism can hide much, they can erase nothing. You can hide, but they erase nothing. We can't just choose to learn what we want to know. We have to learn what we should know. We should know about our country. We should know everything, the good, the bad, the truth of who we are as a nation, the president said. Vice President Kamala Harris voiced a similar sentiment when she opened the noontime ceremony by introducing Parker, who has called Till his best friend. Let us not be seduced into believing that somehow we will be better if we forget, she said. We will be better if we remember. We will be stronger if we remember, because we all here know it is only by understanding and learning from our past that we can continue to work together to build a better future. Brent Leggs, executive director of the National Trust for Historic Preservation's African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund, said he expects the church's sanctuary will be restored to its 1955 condition, and its basement will be modernized to offer tourist videos and other information about the history of the building that dates to 1922. Through our building investigation, we know that the church still retains exceptional architectural integrity and historic fabric. Leggs, whose organization has been leading the preservation plans for the church, told RNS in an interview. And we have enough documentation to fully restore the exterior of the church back to its original appearance in 1955. The forthcoming preservation will allow visitors to step back in time to learn about and relive those fateful days of the civil rights movement, they said. It was in this edifice that Mrs. Till Mobley's courage and strength was fostered for all to see. Bishop J. Drew Sheard, presiding bishop of the Church of God in Christ, a predominantly black denomination, also welcomed the new designation. For today's generation, the monument is a critical symbol of the tribulation endured by African Americans during the harrowing, culture-shifting years of the civil rights era in America, he said. He added that with Till's funeral having been held at a COGIC church, the Church of God in Christ is incredibly humbled to have been a haven for Mrs. Mamie Till Mobley and her family, as they courageously displayed the injustice inflicted upon the young Emmett Till. The African American Culture Heritage Action Fund has provided $750,000 in grants for three sites, including $150,000 for the church. The Action Fund, along with partners including the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation and the Emmett Till and Mamie Till Mobley Institute, has committed an additional $5 million for preservation of the church. Legg's estimated a total of more than $20 million will be needed to complete the church project. He pointed to the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, the site where four young girls were killed in a bombing 60 years ago, as a model for the Chicago church. The Birmingham church continues to hold Sunday services, even as it hosts tourists throughout the week to educate them about the civil rights history of the church and its community. They have found the balance, said Legg's, who expressed hope that preservation of the newly designated sites will provide healing opportunities. By designating the church, courthouse, and river site, our nation can reckon with our past and the injustices still present in American history, he said. Historic preservation is a tool and pathway to ensure that our nation never forgets Emmett Till's life once lived, his mother Mamie Till Mobley's movement for justice, and Reverend Wheeler Parker's dogged pursuit for truth and memorialization. Next, we have an article published by the Associated Press on July 19, written by Nicole Winfield, and entitled, Cardinal Says the Pope's Visit to Mongolia's Tiny Catholic Community Will Show His Dedication. Vatican City. The young cardinal in charge of Mongolia's tiny Catholic community said on July 17 that Pope Francis's upcoming visit to a country with just 1,450 Catholics is evidence of his willingness to travel to the farthest corners of the globe to minister to even a handful of the faithful. Italian Cardinal Giorgio Moringo, who has been a missionary in Mongolia for 2 decades, spoke to reporters after delivering a speech on how Catholic missionaries whisper the gospel in hopes of providing the faith simply and quietly and in one-on-one relationships. When you whisper to an individual or a few people. You cannot whisper to many people at the same time because they simply will not hear you, he said. And I think this visit will also somehow manifest the attention that the Pope has for every individual, every person who embarks in this journey of faith. Francis's August 31st to September 4 visit will take him to a country sandwiched between China and Russia, at a time of Vatican tensions with both. Francis caved into Beijing's unilateral appointment in April of a new bishop for Shanghai and formally confirmed the decision. And in Russia, the Holy See is trying to toe a diplomatic balancing act with Moscow over its invasion of Ukraine. Moringo declined to speculate on the diplomatic implications for the trip, stressing that the first papal visit to Mongolia was evidence more of how Francis's heart burns with love for the universal church, and especially the church where she lives in a minority context. He said that there are 1,450 Catholics in the country, most of them in the capital, Ulaanbaatar. According to statistics by Catholic nonprofit Aid to the Church in Need, Mongolia is 53% Tantric Buddhist, 39% atheist, 3% Muslim, 3% shaman, and 2% Christian. During the visit, Francis will preside over an interfaith meeting and inaugurate a new Catholic charity house that provides assistance for the poor, destitute, and women needing shelter from domestic violence. The 49-year-old Marengo, who became the youngest cardinal when Francis tapped him last year, said he hoped the visit would help the Mongolian faithful understand that they are part of a global religion. "I hope they will feel how wide is the Catholic Church around the world," he said, adding that it's not easy to feel that in Mongolia because Catholics there are so few. Next, we have an article from the Religion News Service, published on the 24th of July, written by Yonat Shimran, and entitled Yeshiva University Adds a Master's Program in Jewish Studies for Christians. Yeshiva University has launched a master's degree program intended specifically for Christian students who want to learn more about Judaism, part of a growing number of academic collaborations at U.S. Christian and Jewish schools that draw students of different faiths. The Hebraic Studies Program for Christian students began this summer as a partnership with the Philos Project, a 9-year-old Christian nonprofit that promotes engagement with Jews. The Philos Project also pays for one-third of the $34,950 tuition cost. Yeshiva provides students with a scholarship covering another third of the tuition. The rest, $11,650, is paid by the students. The program, which enrolled 8 students in its initial cohort, is run through the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Jewish Studies at Yeshiva University. It began with an online summer semester focused on introductory Hebrew. This fall, students will begin taking classes in ancient and modern Jewish history, post-biblical Jewish literature, and Jewish-Christian relations. This is very much in keeping with our graduate school's mission, which is to use the best methodologies to enhance the understanding of Jewish religion, Jewish culture, said Jonathan Dauber, associate professor of Jewish mysticism at Yeshiva and the director of the new program. Although Yeshiva has a rabbinical school that ordains rabbis in the Orthodox tradition, the Rabbi Isaac Elkanon Theological Seminary, the Master of Arts degree program is a separate graduate school offering. The program comes at a time when many seminaries and graduate schools are courting students of different faiths. Nearly all U.S. Jewish schools, including Yeshiva, have long welcomed non-Jewish students to their master's programs. These MA and PhD degrees typically draw non-Jewish students who intend to convert to Judaism or have an academic interest in teaching biblical Hebrew at a university level. Christian seminaries have also sought a greater mix of students. Schools such as Harvard Divinity School, Union Theological Seminary, and Chicago Theological Seminary have expanded beyond their traditional pool of Christian students studying to be pastors to include Muslims, Buddhists, and Jews who are seeking advanced knowledge but not ordination in a Christian church. Christian schools are also drawing more heavily on Jewish institutions to educate them on Judaism. A Lilly Endowment grant to the Association of Theological Schools, for example, has allowed the Academy for Jewish Religion, an independent rabbinical school in Yonkers, New York, to produce a series of short videos about Judaism for ATS member schools. The Academy for Jewish Religion is the only accredited Jewish seminary that is part of ATS. That kind of cross-pollination between Jewish and Christian traditions is part of a greater warming of relations that has come in the wake of the Holocaust. The Yeshiva University program consists of 4 semesters of study. The summer semester was entirely online, but the fall and spring semesters will be a hybrid of online and in-person classes. Joshua Andrew Johnson, a 30-year-old student from Washington State, is one of the initial cohort enrolled in the Yeshiva program. A Christian who attends a Presbyterian church, he wasn't sure whether to pursue an academic career or the pastorate, but he wanted a deeper grounding in the Jewish roots of Christianity. It's something I've always been passionate about, Jewish-Christian relations, understanding how the two faiths became separate, and how Christianity emerged from Judaism as a separate religion, Johnson said. Like most of the students in the program, Johnson was drawn to yeshiva because of its involvement with the Philos Project, the nonprofit that takes its name from the Greek word for friend. Philos works to further what it calls positive Christian engagement with Judaism, and specifically with Israel, although it runs programs across the Middle East and with indigenous Christians too. Robert Nicholson, president and founder of the Philos Project, said a lot of Christians have very little knowledge of Judaism. They are totally unaware of the Jewish side of the story. They see Jews were in the New Testament, and then there's like 1948, and no clue what happened in between, Nicholson said, referring to the year Israel was founded. We're trying to fill in some gaps and just create relationships. Evangelicals have been one of Israel's strongest and most influential supporters, and the Philos Project is no exception. But Nicholson said his staff and programs include Catholics and Orthodox Christians. Not all the students in the program are evangelical. Students apply to the program through Philos. Once admitted, they take classes alongside Jewish students, except for a few classes tailored especially for non-Jews with little background in biblical Hebrew. One of our goals for this program is to foster dialogue, because there will be Christian students and Jewish students together in the same classroom talking to each other, Dauber said. Christian Charrier, who recently completed an undergraduate degree at Regent University, said he was drawn to the Yeshiva program after becoming enamored with the Old Testament, or Hebrew Bible, as part of a biblical studies major. This is a way to better understand the Jewish faith and learn it from their narrative and their story, instead of having a solely evangelical perspective on how Jewish thought works, said Charrier, who is 23. So I think it's a really unique opportunity. The next article was published by the Religion News Service on July 25, written by Jana Reese, and entitled, Irish Mormons Face Dwindling Numbers, but Researcher Finds Their Community Inspirational. What is it like to be a Mormon in the Emerald Isle? On a trip last week to Dublin and Belfast for a conference, I learned a bit about that by interviewing Hazel O'Brien, a lecturer in sociology at Southeast Technological University, about her book, Irish Mormons, Reconciling Identity in Global Mormonism. The Republic of Ireland has a small but committed core group of members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, mostly concentrated in and around Dublin, the capital. The Republic doesn't include the 6 counties of Northern Ireland, which remained part of the United Kingdom when Ireland left in 1922. O'Brien isn't a Mormon. Raised Catholic, like the majority of people in Ireland, she describes herself as non-religious. But she spent a year doing deep diving ethnographic research into LDS congregations. One, an established ward with about 70 attendees, and the other a smaller branch with around 30. Those numbers themselves tell part of the story. If you look at the church's official statistics, LDS membership growth in Ireland looks healthy over the last decade. There were 3,013 members in 2013 and 3,980 in 2022, a 32% increase in just under 10 years. On the other hand, no new congregations have been created in Ireland over that period, which suggests poor retention of new converts and other members. What's more, according to the recently released 2022 census, only 1,111 people in Ireland said that they were Mormon, a figure that includes both adults and children. This means that 72% of those the church claims as members do not declare themselves as such. But that's not the only challenge facing Latter-day Saints in Ireland, I learned. This interview with O'Brien has been edited for length and clarity. Let's talk about the origins of your research. Why did you choose this topic? It's a mix. I think of the personal and the professional. From a personal perspective, I definitely was a Celtic tiger baby. I came of age when Ireland's economic growth was at its highest. We were one of the wealthiest and most successful nations in the world in the late 1990s and early 2000s. And I was very much struck by the social and economic change that had taken place in Ireland from when I was a child. What would that feel like on the ground for people who maybe experience life as an Irish person differently than I do? And then, from a professional perspective, I was reading around the sociology of religion and religion's relationship to race in Ireland. And one of the things that struck me was that a lot of the studies that had been done in Ireland previously very much focused on religious minorities who were also racial or ethnic minorities. That meant we had a lot of information emerging on the likes of Hinduism and Islam, but less from small religions whose members would be majority white. I was intrigued by that. It's important to tell the story of that experience too, because otherwise we're getting a monolithic narrative that all non-Catholics in Ireland are also foreign-born or not white. You note that it can be hard for people to convert to Mormonism and that it can drive a wedge in families because the Catholic identity is so synonymous with Irish identity. The U.S., I think, is just so much more familiar with religious diversity and accepting of religious diversity. And to seek out new parts of yourself is something that's often celebrated there. The same is not necessarily true in the Irish context. For some reason, we still penalize those we think are different. I think the reason Ireland has become that way is tied up with our history. The formation of our nation as an independent state, separate from the British in the early 20th century, was very much based on a deliberate decision to create a new, culturally Catholic national identity. We very deliberately tried to focus on what the British were not. So, if the British were Protestant, we would be Catholic. And if they spoke English, we would try even harder to reclaim Irish as our language. This worked so well that as the 20th century progressed, the two things were really interchangeable. To be Irish was to be Catholic, and vice versa. That leads us into a situation where, all these generations later, even in the midst of a lot of liberalization and the decline of the Catholic Church, it can still sometimes be seen as a huge loss to the family if somebody converts to a different religion. It's leaving something of Irishness behind you if you've chosen this other religion that's often viewed as foreign. And being foreign, specifically American, is a problem for the LDS Church in Ireland. With Mormonism, having a strong association with the U.S. is a particular challenge. As I spoke to people, I was really struck by how part of the challenge for the church and growing its membership in Ireland is going to be to truly represent itself as a global religion, as opposed to an American religion. And whiteness is very much in view with that. There is a presumption that when we speak about being an American religion, we're talking about a white American religion. That's the bit that often goes unsaid. And that's a real challenge because in Ireland, the bulk of conversions to Mormonism are coming from those who are recent arrivals into Europe. Often those people are not white, and they don't have an Irish or a European cultural heritage. So if the church continues to present itself as being a white American religion, it's going to struggle to hold on to those people. Ireland has a complicated and bitter history with its former colonizer, England. You write how it can be hard for Irish Latter-day Saints that the church's administrative structure lumps it together with the UK. Ireland's position is a fascinating debate, even within the scholarly literature. Some will argue that Ireland does not fit the criteria of a colonized nation, that Ireland was not one of Britain's colonies in the same way that many other countries would have been historically. But there's no doubt that there was huge resource exploitation and a control of the Irish and their cultural identity in a similar way that we might have seen in other countries. I was really quite surprised at the extent of some of the bitterness I have encountered from some people toward how the church bundles Ireland with the UK. Many Irish church members were saying they felt that Ireland and the UK were already overlooked because the church still has such an American focus. This also affects missionary efforts. Ireland is bundled with Scotland as a mission area. This means the church does not always fully appreciate how member recruitment might differ in the Republic of Ireland to Northern Ireland or Scotland because of cultural differences. There are lessons in that work that members can use outside of church too, particularly in a social environment which is increasingly polarized. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News, so be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.